Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 3, Natural Selection and Adaptation.
As its name implies, evolutionary psychology is grounded in the theory of evolution. But what is that theory, and how is it applied? Most people know that the modern theory of evolution was proposed by Charles Darwin in his most famous book, On the Origin of Species, first published in November of 1859. What most people who have not read Darwin's book don't know is that he actually proposed two theories. That living species have changed over time, beginning with one or a few ancestral forms, which have diverged into the bewildering diversity we see today and in the fossil record. And that the mechanism by which this divergence has occurred is natural selection, and that natural selection also explains how adaptations, that is, the characteristics of living organisms that appear to serve some function or purpose, have come into existence. Theories of evolution have been around for at least the past 3 millennia. What made Darwin's theory different was that the mechanism that he proposed for change over time also explained the origin of adaptations, and did so without requiring any intervention into nature by a guiding intelligence. In doing so, Darwin brought natural history into line with the other natural sciences, such as physics and chemistry, and thereby founded that branch of the natural sciences we now know as biology. Before we can get into evolutionary psychology, we need to examine Darwin's theory more closely, as a thorough understanding of natural selection is absolutely necessary for any understanding of evolutionary psychology. Natural selection, according to Darwin, has 4 necessary prerequisites. The first is variety. There must be real variations in the characteristics of the individuals that make up a population of organisms. By real variations, we mean differences between the structures and functions of organisms, such that the members of any population are not absolutely identical to each other. The second prerequisite is heredity. Some of these variations must be heritable from parents to offspring. Darwin did not propose a mechanism by which variations could be inherited in the origin of species. He simply pointed out the obvious fact that inheritance of structures and functions from parents to offspring does indeed occur. Fecundity. Parents must reproduce at a rate that more than replaces them. In Darwin's version of the theory, individuals reproduce at the maximum possible rate, which means that many more offspring are produced than can possibly survive. More recent theories have modified this condition somewhat, but reproduction is still an undeniable part of natural selection and an equally undeniable characteristic of living organisms. And finally, demography. Some individuals survive and reproduce more often than others. Sometimes, who survives and reproduces and who doesn't is essentially accidental. However, Darwin's theory is based on the assumption that survival and reproduction is usually influenced by the heritable characteristics of individuals. That is, one can infer a necessary relationship between particular structures and functions and the rate at which individuals with those characteristics survive and reproduce. None of these prerequisites require anything special. Indeed, they are conditions that anyone can immediately observe among the living organisms around us. Furthermore, none of them require any intelligent guidance, which means that they're all natural processes. Darwin simply took the next logical step. He proposed that the outcome of the operation of these four processes is that the heritable characteristics of those individuals that survive and reproduce more often than others become more common in their population over time. This result, unequal, non-random survival and reproduction, is what Darwin called natural selection. In The Origin of Species, Darwin also proposed that a very similar mechanism, which he called sexual selection, can produce adaptations that are similar to those produced by natural selection. In sexual selection, individuals who can choose their mates do so by basing their choice on their potential mate's characteristics. The characteristics of those individuals who are chosen more often as mates become more common over time, just as those characteristics that result in increased survival and reproduction do. We call the heritable characteristics of living organisms that have evolved as the result of natural or sexual selection evolutionary adaptations. We've also noticed that evolutionary adaptations appear to accomplish particular functions for the organisms that have them. For example, fur is considered to be an evolutionary adaptation of mammals. Fur, like many of the anatomical and physiological characteristics of mammals and other organisms, is a heritable characteristic that appears to solve a problem for the existence of the organisms that have them. However, while it is very tempting to say that mammals have fur in order to keep warm, from an evolutionary viewpoint, we should say instead that mammals today have fur because their ancestors that had fur survived and reproduced more often than their contemporaries that lacked fur. This way of thinking about evolutionary adaptations avoids the assumption that adaptations must have a purpose, an assumption based on the idea that purpose exists in nature, an assumption which is untestable and indeed is a philosophically unnecessary assumption. Our tendency to think about nature in terms of problems and solutions is itself a behavioral adaptation of humans. Because we are purposeful in our behavior, indeed, we have evolved brain mechanisms to both act purposefully and to detect such purposefulness in others, we tend to infer purpose in the events around us. Some of those events, such as being winked at by a flirt, do indeed have purposes motivating them and are produced by intentional agents. Our neurological agency detector, which experimental tests have located in the posterior superior temporal cortex of the brain, correctly infers that such events are the result of intentional agency, and we respond appropriately. However, as should be obvious to all but the most paranoid, there are events that appear to be the result of intentional agency, but which clearly are not. Instead, such events are the result of purely natural processes, which happen without intentional agency, which are therefore assumed to have natural rather than intentional causes. For example, if you're riding a bicycle and encounter a strong headwind, you might be tempted to assume that this is the result of intentional agency. Sometimes feels like the wind wants to impede our forward progress. This is a common conclusion of both children and adults who've been trained to think of nature as consisting of an intentional agent analogous to humans and other animals. Obviously, it is possible to explain the existence of a headwind without including any reference to intentions or purposes. And so most adults, especially those who are trained in naturalism, such as scientists, assume that things like wind have no intentions or purposes, but simply happen as the result of natural processes. Our tendency to infer the existence of intentional agency in natural processes is a particular problem for evolutionary biologists, and even more so for evolutionary psychologists. As Richard Dawkins has pointed out in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, evolution by natural selection produces characteristics of living organisms, that is, adaptations, that appear to be intentionally designed to solve problems of survival and reproduction. However, this appearance of purposeful intentionality in natural processes is an illusion, one that is the result of our own evolved mental propensities. The most revolutionary aspect of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection was that it explained the origin and operation of such adaptations by purely natural, that is, unintentional, means. This is, of course, the aspect of Darwin's theory that most troubles most people, especially those committed to the existence of supernatural intentional entities that intervene either directly or indirectly in natural processes. However, even if one does not believe in such supernatural entities, the tendency to think of evolutionary adaptations as solutions to problems can lead to difficulties. This is because not every characteristic of an organism is, in fact, an adaptation, and those that are can sometimes be very difficult to verify as such. Determining whether or not a particular characteristic of an organism is an adaptation is not a trivial exercise. This is because our agency detectors tend to be biased towards agency detection, even when such agency isn't there. This bias means that we almost never fail to detect agency when it is present, but we have a tendency to detect it even when it isn't present. There is an evolutionary explanation for this bias towards false positives by our agency detectors. False positives don't generally result in harm. Believing that something is happening on purpose when it isn't, that is, when it's the result of purely natural causes like wind, rarely, if ever, affects our survival or reproduction. However, false negatives can easily result in harm. If we fail to recognize and infer the intentions of an entity intent on doing us harm, such as a predator, a thief, or an enemy during a potentially deadly encounter, such failure can be damaging or even fatal. In the context of our earlier discussion of cooperation, even being unable to detect cheaters, that is, individuals who are intent on non-reciprocated self-interest, can have long-term negative fitness consequences. Hence, our agency detectors are adapted in such a way as to produce virtually no false negatives, which means that they're inevitably biased towards yielding false positives. Ultimately, the gold standard for determining if a characteristic is an adaptation is showing empirically that there's a direct linkage between that characteristic and increased relative survival and reproduction. In the case of evolutionary psychology, this means that to determine if a particular behavior, or more properly, the capacity to perform a particular behavior, is an adaptation, we must be able to show that the behavior results in increased survival and reproduction relative to some alternative behavior. What makes this difficult is that this is often done by arguing that the behavior in question solves a problem posed by the environment in such a way as to increase the fitness of the individual performing it. While this problem-solving technique is quite common and quite seductive in its apparent simplicity, it often runs afoul of our innate agency detectors, which convince us that the behavior is adaptive when it doesn't necessarily result in differential survival and reproduction at all. This is often referred to as telling just-so stories, in reference to the popular stories by Rudyard Kipling, in which the existence of some characteristic, such as the camel's hump or the elephant's trunk, is explained by referring to the intentions of supernatural entities, such as genies. However, natural explanations do not involve either intentions or supernatural entities. And since evolution by natural selection is a natural process, its products, that is, adaptations, must have natural explanations as well. Therefore, in all of our investigations of the evolutionary roots of human behavior, we must be able to show that the behaviors that we suspect are adaptive are either directly or indirectly related to differential survival and reproduction. Related to the problem of purpose is the tendency to assume that adaptive behaviors necessarily result in increased personal happiness and well-being. It is very common for people not versed in evolutionary biology to assume that if a particular action makes you feel happy or good, it must be adaptive. Nothing could be further from reality. As E.O. Wilson, the author of Sociobiology, one of the foundational texts in evolutionary psychology, said, "We do what we do not to promote the happiness or survival of the individual, but to favor the maximum transmission of the controlling genes." As we will see, happiness and well-being are essentially irrelevant to fitness in an evolutionary sense. We will see many examples of human behaviors that result in pain, misery, and even death, but which also have the effect of increasing relative reproductive success, and are therefore adaptive, even though they also cause unhappiness and discomfort. We will also see some examples of human behaviors that result in happiness and well-being, but which do not have fitness consequences. Such behaviors, while enjoyable, do not qualify as evolutionary adaptations. In other words, nature, including human nature, was not created for us. We were created by it. Nature doesn't, indeed, it can't, care about us at all. Not as individuals, nor groups, nor even as a species. And natural selection is as pitiless and unforgiving and as mindless and unavoidable as gravity. This means that the characteristics of living organisms can be classified into one of three categories: adaptations, side effects of adaptations, and accidents. Once again, adaptations are characteristics that result in increased survival and reproduction. An example of a human behavior that is clearly an adaptation is suckling. Newborn humans, like virtually all newborn mammals, suck on their mother's nipples for nourishment. Suckling behavior, which includes a stereotyped side-to-side searching behavior, locating and grasping, and sometimes squeezing, kneading, or even punching the breast, taking the nipple into the mouth and sucking it, often pretty hard, and continuing to do so until satiated, are all innate behavioral adaptations of newborns that have evolved as the result of natural selection. Any newborn that cannot perform this behavior starves to death, and those that perform it less than optimally have a lowered probability of survival and subsequent reproduction, at least during our evolutionary history. Some behaviors are side effects of behavioral adaptations. That is, they occur because they share some of the neuromuscular circuitry as behavioral adaptations, but are not themselves adaptive. An example in humans, related to the first example, is thumb sucking. A surprisingly large fraction of human infants suck their thumbs, or their fingers, or sometimes toes, and other vaguely nipple-shaped objects, and seem to derive quite a lot of pleasure from it. However, they do not derive any nourishment from it at all, and there's no evidence that thumb-sucking, or the lack of it among babies that can suckle the breast normally, is adaptive. That is, both thumb-suckers and non-thumb-suckers appear to survive and reproduce in equal numbers, as long as they suckle normally. Therefore, thumb-sucking, which is not an adaptation, is a side effect of suckling, which is an evolutionary adaptation. Finally, some behaviors are apparently purely accidental. An example in humans is which thumb is on top when you interlace your fingers. When people close their hands and interlace their fingers, the thumb that is on top, that is, not between the other thumb and the index finger, is virtually always the same thumb. It's either the right or the left. Indeed, many people have difficulty interlacing their fingers in such a way as to put the other thumb on top. And when they do, it feels very, very odd. Although this characteristic is apparently the result of the expression of a simple Mendelian gene, left thumb on top is apparently dominant, regardless of handedness. It has no measurable adaptive significance that we can determine, and it's therefore a complete accident. In all our investigations and discussions of evolutionary psychology, we must distinguish between these three kinds of behaviors, because only the first two have direct or indirect fitness consequences. This is because only behaviors that are the result of consistent causes produce consistent effects and can therefore be reliably explained and predicted. One of the ultimate goals of science is to understand causes and effects well enough to be able to reliably predict the future. Scientists try to do this by observing the present and the past to see if there are consistent patterns in the objects and processes we observe. If there are such patterns, we then try to apply our understanding of those patterns to future events. Underlying all such predictions is a basic principle in the natural sciences, which we've already encountered. That is, similar causes result in similar effects. It is common among scientists to refer to these consistent patterns of cause and effect as natural laws. As we go forward, it is important to keep in mind that such natural laws are neither absolute nor immune to change. Indeed, one of the things that distinguishes the natural sciences from some other modes of human explanation is that the natural laws that scientists discover are neither absolute nor permanent. Rather, they are constantly being refined and sometimes fundamentally changed as a result of new discoveries. Before moving on to the details of evolutionary psychology, I'd like to review one more time Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. As outlined earlier, evolution by natural selection has four prerequisites, none of which are necessarily intentional. The first is variety. There must be significant variations between individuals and populations. Heredity. Some of those variations must be heritable from parents to offspring. Fecundity. Individuals must be able to reproduce and pass on those heritable variations. And finally, demography. Some individuals survive and reproduce more often than others. The outcome of these four prerequisites is that some heritable traits become more common over time in populations. We call these heritable traits, the ones that become more common in populations over time, evolutionary adaptations. Evolutionary psychology, like the science of animal behavior, is based on the idea that behaviors, or to be more precise, the capacity for particular behaviors are evolutionary adaptations, fundamentally no different than things like eyes, ears, and opposable thumbs. Evolutionary psychology is about the empirical analysis of behavioral adaptations from an evolutionary viewpoint. What makes evolutionary psychology so exciting is that it is in the very beginning stages of the establishment of a new natural science. During these early stages, sciences typically go through a period of very rapid change, and many principles that were previously thought to be close to permanently settled are suddenly up for grabs. Old ideas are reformatted using new discoveries, and in this process of rethinking, lots of new terms are often coined to better define our changing perception of how nature works. In the next lecture, we will consider one of the most important new concepts in evolutionary psychology, the concept of evolved psychological mechanisms. As we will see, evolved psychological mechanisms are essentially evolutionary behavioral adaptations. Unlike such adaptations as fur or teeth or wings, evolved psychological mechanisms are not directly observable. We cannot see the underlying biological machinery by which such mechanisms operate, but we can observe the patterns of outcome that they produce. Like Darwin's assumption about the inheritance of variations, we do not yet know what the underlying biological mechanisms for such behavioral adaptations are. But, as we will see, we can discern many interesting and even surprising patterns in human behavior and can correlate these patterns with our evolutionary history. In the next lecture, we will be discussing evolved psychological mechanisms. As we get ready to consider evolved psychological mechanisms, it might be useful to consider how we know that evolved psychological mechanisms even exist. How can we tell the difference, for example, between an evolved psychological mechanism, something like suckling, for example, which we've already talked about in this lecture, and something that is almost certainly purely learned, such as which socks you put on in the morning when you get up? Notice that both suckling and which sock you put on, which foot, when you first get up in the morning, are highly stereotyped behaviors. That is, they happen almost exactly the same way every time you do them. Most people aren't aware of this, but when you put your socks on, you almost always put on the same sock each time. It is just as unlikely that which sock you put on in the morning is an evolutionary adaptation as suckling is likely to be an evolutionary adaptation. So, how can we tell, going forward, what characteristics or what behavioral capacities of humans qualify as evolved psychological mechanisms, that is, behavioral capacities that have an underlying biological function, and those behavioral capacities that are purely learned and really don't have any underlying biological function at all that we can detect. Think about it. How can we tell whether something is a biological process or one that has biological components and one that is almost certainly purely learned and purely culturally determined?
This ends Lecture 3.